Sent committee substitute for committee substitute for House Bill 322, the oil and gas income tax. And today is the day we've been waiting for. We want to hear from Commissioner Sterling Gallagher. Madam Chairman and members of the Senate Resources Committee, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify to you on this important issue of income taxation for the oil industry. Last year, I testified at great length on the specifics of income tax bills which were before your committee, including the Governor's Franchise Tax Bill and the Surrey County Bill, which is now before you. Rather than rehashing those points and arguments, I'd like to speak to you on what I believe is the most important issue: establishing an effective and equitable tax system for the oil and gas industry in Alaska.
Commissioner Gallagher, I think some people down here are having a little trouble hearing you, so if you could speak just a little louder, please.
I have that problem. I'll speak up. By effective, I mean a tax system which is free of the special corporate tax loopholes and which is accurately measured by actual business activity and earnings in the state, so that effective tax rates approximate statutory tax rates on income produced in the state. By equitable, I mean a tax system which places multi-state corporations on a par with local corporations. That is, multi-state oil corporations must share equitably and equally in the corporate tax income tax payments to the state based upon their earnings and activities in the state. Until an income tax system which is both effective and equitable is adopted for the oil and gas industry, I believe we will have tax instability. Until this inequity with the income tax system is dealt with once and for all, there will be continual pressure for change, and it will be an issue before the legislature every single year until it is resolved. For several years now, the legislature's oil and gas consultants, Walter Levy and Associates, have recommended a revamping of the corporate income tax as applied to the oil and gas industry. For the last 3 years, several bills have been introduced in the legislature to deal with income taxes. Last year, both the Department of Revenue and a special committee of the Legislative Council made extensive studies of Alaska's corporate income tax as applied to the oil and gas corporations, and made specific recommendations to reform the income tax. I believe that this year is the time to finally reform Alaska's corporate income tax. As stated by the Department of Resources, the oil and gas industry pays an effective Alaska income tax rate of between 2 or 3% of Alaska income. This results from two factors: a substantially eroded federal tax base and an inappropriate apportionment formula. The combination of these factors then results in multi-state oil corporations paying less tax than that of local corporations on the same income earned in the state. This ineffectiveness of our income tax is easily displayed by simply examining the actual income tax payments made by the oil industry over the past few years and looking at our projections of future income tax collections. For example, it wasn't until the 1973 tax year that corporate income tax payments from the oil industry finally crept above the $1 million mark. During the past 3 years, oil company income tax payments have totaled $2.1 million, $3.7 million, and $4.4 million, respectively. In fact, total corporate income tax payments from the oil industry for the last 7 years have been only $13,108,000. This represents 9.4% of approximately $140,510,000 in taxable income over the last 7 years. To view this taxable income reported by the oil industry in perspective, you need only multiply last year's oil production from cook inlet times 50% of its average wellhead value to find that it exceeds the total income tax by Alaska for the past 7 years. In fact, the 7 years of reportable income represents a little less than 25 cents per barrel of the oil produced from cook inlet over the same 7 year period. These reported income tax figures do not, I believe, represent the net income earned, nor reflect the activities in Alaska of these companies during this period. Nor is this inequitable situation likely to change much in the future years, even as a result of a higher possible crude oil production. Based upon actual tax returns information, we are only estimating an additional corporate income tax revenue as a result of crude oil production over the next 2 years of $2.3 million and $23.6 million, respectively. Again, this represents only a slight return from the substantial income earned and the activities taking place in the state. This information is in marked contrast to the predictions of likely income tax revenues provided by the oil industry and their consultants. For example, last year in Soheil Submission No. 1, Soheil assumed corporate income tax revenues to the state of Alaska of $27.4 million in 1977 and $62 million in 1978 if oil were sold in California for $13 per barrel. In addition, the Arthur Anderson study shows Alaska income tax revenues of $1,747,100 over a 25-year period on an average of $69 per year. Going back, we only estimate $27 million in 1977, so we're really getting behind the power curve there.
Was that $69 million per year?
Yes, average.
You said dollars.
These representations of income tax collections just don't match the past tax returns of the oil industry or the likely returns in the near future. Again, let me emphasize that we need an effective corporate income tax, one that truly reflects the business activity and income earned in the state. In response to facts of the actual effective income tax rates paid by the oil industry, you've heard substantial testimony by the oil industry consultants justifying the result of low effective tax rates in the name of uniformity. I, too, believe that uniformity is a laudable goal for the state, and that is why I and my department are active participants in the multi-state tax program and the multi-state tax commission. This does not mean, however, that we should blindly try to lockstep in the name of uniformity and ignore our responsibilities of providing an effective and equitable corporate income tax system. I believe that we have a duty to ensure that the corporate income tax system returns to state tax revenues which accurately reflect the business activity and income earned in the state, even if the income is earned by corporations that do business throughout the world. The actual income tax revenues received today and projections of future income tax revenues do not, I believe, reflect the substantial business activities and profits earned in Alaska in the past years and the future by these multinational corporations. I do not think we can tolerate any longer the corporate income tax system on the oil industry, which allows multinational corporations to avoid taxes by substantial earnings by taking advantage of all the special federal tax and accounting devices and by the use of an apportionment formula which does not accurately represent oil industry activity in the state. In addition, I do not think we can tolerate a system which, because of these loopholes and unrepresentative formulas, allow local corporations to pay a higher effective tax rate than multinational corporations from like activities. I therefore ask for your favorable consideration of an effective and equitable corporate income tax for the oil and gas industry. I believe that the tax bill which we have proposed meets this criteria. That bill would have eliminated all the corporate loopholes through the adoption of the book income definition of taxable income. It also would have solved the problem of a portion of the formula by substituting extraction factor for the sales factor, and thereby providing a more accurate measure of oil industry activity and income in the state. I believe that bill would, for the first time, provide both an effective and equitable income tax for oil and gas corporations. As you know, however, I am opposed to the specific bill that is before you, since I believe that would leave us with just another ineffective income tax. I am opposed to this bill because it would allow one part of a business to calculate its own tax liability based upon such items as intercompany transportation charges. Thus, we could probably be left in the same situation that we find ourselves today with severance tax and royalty computations. That is, income substantially reduced by inflated transportation charges. Therefore, I ask for your favorable consideration for the approach contained in the original House Bill 322 and establish an effective income tax on the oil and gas industry.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher.
Do you really believe that the income tax is the best way, the most equitable way, to get at the taxing rights for the oil companies?
Senator, I guess we have to go back and ask what you're trying to tax. If we're seeking to raise money, if we're seeking to raise money, I think the most effective way is through a severance tax. But it's been traditional in states also to have an income tax in addition to capturing net profits. I think we should also have an effective income tax bill and the issue, I guess, is whether we have an effective and efficient tax system in capturing those things that we're trying to capture.
But if we can measure this in terms of an aggregate tax, total tax that they pay, isn't it a much cleaner technique and much simpler to deal with it in terms of a severance tax, rather than to go maybe a quote traditional approach?
Please run the question by me again.
I'm thinking maybe in terms, in as much as we have several vehicles for taxing, it seems to me that maybe we might want to pursue one that was a little easier to determine the money coming to the state, a little cleaner to operate or to detect in terms of the taxes owed, compared to a more difficult to administer program of an income tax.
Well, there are methods under an income tax approach that you can get closer to determining what that actual income. I guess the issue is whether you use a gross tax system or one that's measured by net income. There are measures you can do under an income tax system that could accurately reflect that income. The issue is having an effective tax system. Or one that
you consider a severance tax an effective tax.
I absolutely believe it's the most effective tax.
And that's not the appropriate vehicle to pursue additional taxation on income tax.
What I'm saying, I think if you have an income tax, I believe you should have an effective income tax.
Are you saying we should have an income tax?
I believe we should have an income tax.
Apply over the severance tax techniques. If the severance tax is cleaner to get at, and what the primary benefit of the income tax is that it's conventional.
Severance tax only taxes one part of the industry, only taxes extraction. There are other phases of the industry, like transportation, refining, marketing, all those, which the corporate income tax is much more capable of getting a handle on the income tax.
But wouldn't you agree, essentially, that there is some unfairness in terms of an income tax coupled with all the other taxes that they're paying? I'm concerned only about an aggregate tax, and at the bottom of the line, and you add it all up, regardless of what we call it, the oil industry is to pay or should pay a fair share or a total amount of tax equivalent to the effort in the state. And is it possible to get at that in a clear way than the frustration of the income tax? That's right.
Well, there are ways to make some of the frustration of the income tax, too. I mean, I understand your concern for the total tax debt. But I think you have to look at, when you pass each measure, what the total effect is.
Well, I don't know whether my question is for Sterling or for Senator Sumner, but isn't what Senator Sumner is proposing is to exempt the oil business from income tax and leave the rest of us with income tax? Isn't that the sum total result? It's a confusion, because we have a severance tax at present, Madam Chairman, and it's supposedly, in my way of thinking, I've been told that it's for severing a non-renewable resource that is forever gone from the state, and the effects that this has upon the state by building up in order to do it, so on and so forth, and many things that apply. So I should think that we're on a different subject. Maybe Senator Sumner wants to remove the income tax burden from all of us. I might be happy to join him in the bill, but I'm trying to find out if this isn't just to remove it from the oil companies. In that case, shouldn't there be a bill before us that is to exempt oil companies from income tax because they pay a severance tax? I'm not in favor of that kind of thing, but this is why I think this is a confusion. Rather than, it confuses me more than anything else.
Well, Madam Chairman, you know, consistently at this meeting, I hear a disclaimer by Senator Schumer that it's this subject that confuses him. I think a lot of subjects confusing, and this one, I think that it deals largely with the fact that aggregate taxes is what we're getting at. And it doesn't matter to me in terms of what we call it. Somewhere the oil industry will pay a tax. I don't care, and I would support to the degree that it's feasible that we remove or eliminate the income tax from all citizens to the degree that can be compensated in some terms of resource dollars. The question here is aggregate tax, and the best way, the fairest way, to reach that, the most economical way to reach that. And we've heard terms of separate accounting and multinational or multi-state tax. And it seems to me that the term aggregate has some value and should be considered by this committee and by the legislature. And I'm concerned with the total amount of tax they pay. And the cleanest way, the less complicated way there is to get there. That was my concerns about this. Not that I was attempting to set the oil industry out to eliminate them from paying their fair share or obligated share of the tax base of the state.
I can appreciate the point, though, that Senator Sumner was bringing out, because we have had the same idea tackled by both of our U.S. senators who were here this past week.
No,
not in the budget.
Madam Chairman, I'm sure I wasn't willing to get the original governor's House bill for the committee substitute for it, and then we have the Senate committee substitute. Have you furnished us with any charts on those three bills, the dollar production charts?
I believe we even ran the last year's various bills. Yes, in our tax government, and also legislative affairs.
Thank you.
was in our tax levy last year. I don't recall the numbers off the top of my head. And there are various fiscal notes around.
We'll have
to
read those down to send it back to you. I'm interested in pursuing another line of questioning rather than Senator Sumner's line of questioning. And that is, I noticed that Sterling testified that the amounts of money received from Cook Inlet. And I note, Madam Chairman, that Cook Inlet at one recent comparison of 200,000 barrels a day against the projected 2 million out of Prudhoe Bay leaves it as something like 1/10 of the size of Prudhoe Bay. And I wonder if Sterling would give us the total amounts. I think we've had Cook Inlet about 17 years, the total amounts of income tax that the oil industry has paid during that time. This would be, I guess, in comparison with what they would pay if they were a state corporation doing the same business.
Senator, the last 7 years, I have the numbers, that's 13,108,000. Before then, it was a lot of the corporations on separate accounting. In those years, we showed negative incomes.
Negative incomes? Could you explain that?
Well, we showed us tax loss in the state. That's one of the things that was in our report last year, the legislature. I don't think we'd add over. If we went back to 1957, we'd add over $2 million to that 13 million. Go back. But like the first year, I gave you figures for the last 3 years. The year before that was $400,000.
Have you tried in any way to work this against the possible true profitability, such as working it against, we could come up with a scale of true profitability if we knew what the profit is they make per barrel, or what the investment is they have per barrel, the operating expenses per barrel, capital investment, and everything else. So we'd have an absolute scale on per barrel of oil, what the profit is. Have you tried working that out? You do have access to the income tax records and so forth?
I think we did it, the profitability study last year in Cooking, but I think that information was forwarded to this committee. As to how it compares to these numbers, my mind is not bringing it back. I'd be happy to get that and load that information to you.
Make some kind of comparison also with what you project off of Prudhoe Bay, of course. I think most of us have been led to believe that Prudhoe Bay is even more profitable than Cook Inlet, but maybe it is or maybe it isn't. I'd like to have some idea on that.
Arthur Anderson said that they would at least show $69 million.
again, which I think tends to overstate our relative standing. Some states have different tax rates that apply to gas than applies to oil. For instance, our tax rate is 10% below the rate that applies to oil. Other states, again, have different rates. For instance, Texas has a higher tax rate for gas than it does for oil, and Louisiana has, again, a different tax rate for gas than it does for oil. So, again, I think it's important, in looking at the actual burden, to look at total statewide activities. Perhaps the most single factor, which I think is important, is what is the effect of your tax rate, or what is your relative burden with regard to the future production and development of what might be termed marginal fields. If you saw that slide presentation put together by the Oil and Gas Association a few weeks ago, you might recall one of the questions towards the end of that slide production, which basically said, what effect is Alaska's tax structure going to be on the possible future development of Kuparuk and Lisburn, which most people consider at this point to be marginal fields? And I think that is a good question, and I think a study to be complete should look at that. And again, I think Alaska comes out on the right side of that question in terms of it's taking care of those tax structure, which takes care of those marginal fields by reducing the tax rate on marginal fields. And in fact, as those fields reach their margin, their tax rate actually becomes zero. Other states, on the other hand, apply just a flat rate or percentage to the wellhead value and do not take into account the economics of a particular property. And therefore, I think, again, to get a good view of Alaska's tax policy and its tax structure, you need to look at the entire state, in particular, what effect would the tax structure have on a marginal field? With regard to the general approach taken by the Arthur Anderson study, we agree that it could possibly give a rough approximation of the tax burden, and it's relatively simple to compute compared to what other approaches might be. That is, taking other states' tax structures and imposing them on the activities in Alaska. But we think that it's important to note that there are some definite limitations to that approach, and that the people realize that does not. That higher tax revenues would be generated from that activity in the state, other than what it would generate if it was in the state. Another approach to test the validity of the Arthur Anderson approach would be, I think, to assume that other states were doing a study similar to that proposed by Arthur Anderson in each of those other states. So that, for example, you would look at that state's tax structure and Alaska's tax structure on their facts. What sort of tax would be generated if in California or Texas or Louisiana, if on their properties, if they had Alaska's tax rate? I think if you compare those other two approaches to the Arthur Anderson approach, and came up with the same relative ranking, I think you might perhaps be more satisfied that this gives a rough approximation of relative tax burden. But if you found, for example, that if you took Alaska's tax structure to Texas or Louisiana and got a different result, different ranking, then I think you might conclude that the result obtained under this approach was because tax structures of a particular state are adopted to fit a particular state's economics. And it's not very useful to take tax structures of one state and apply to the economics of another state. It might not just work. So again, we think that there's some drawbacks to that approach. The third area is computational errors, which we found, and the one area would be the Alaska severance tax computation. In their Arthur Anderson study, they computed an average production over 25 years and took a rough weighted average of what would be the presumption of an economic limit factor to come up with an effective tax rate of, I think, about 10.2%. The problem with the calculation was that they didn't take a true weighted average year by year, and if they would have taken a weighted average year by year for obtaining an economic limit factor, you would have obtained severance tax revenues below what they showed. The other major computational problem we saw was the computation of the income tax revenues. It is noted in testimony before the committee, it was shown that they computed their income tax by taking worldwide income figures from the financial statements of the companies and setting on top of that a separate accounting method, and then with the combination of those two things, they then apportioned. That is not the way that the Alaska income tax works presently. Basically, taking the federal taxable income definition of taxable income worldwide and apportioning that to Alaska. So the combination of taking book income figures and adding separate accounting on top of that and then apportioning, you get a much inflated tax base. And since Alaska's nominal tax rate is the greatest, and since it had this inflated tax base, you get greater income tax revenues shown for Alaska. So I think a combination of the scope and the approach and the errors, I think, lead me to conclude that
that the study really isn't that helpful in answering the question, what is Alaska's relative tax burden? I have copies of my memorandum which outlines the details of our review.
Thank you, Mr. Messenger. John, one question for you. You've analyzed the referendum and quite rather well, I believe. Would there not be one more system that might be more fair in determining what the taxes that should be paid by the oil companies in Alaska, and that would be an absolute one involving their investment per barrel, their tax per barrel, their expenses of operating per barrel, and their final bottom figure, their profit per barrel, compared with each of these other states? Wouldn't that have also been an equitable approach?
Yeah, I think probably the best of all comparisons would be to look at each state, go to each state, get their production, and find out production, the total production per barrel, the costs of production, and actually figure out the profit earned in that state on their production, and maybe break it down per barrel, and then view the tax payments in that state as a percentage of that total profit or profit per barrel. I think that might theoretically give you the best
approach in writing a relative tax burden.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wanted to follow online. Would you agree that, or did you say, that one of the major problems or primary difficulties in the study was that it did not include the Kenai area? Is that one of the significant fallacies in the study?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Now, would you say it was the most significant?
Well, I think it may not be the most significant in terms of tax dollars, but it may be the most significant in terms of depicting Alaska's tax burden or showing our tax policy. I think what you find out is a state's tax structure. Our burden is not one burden, but several burdens. For a very profitable venture, you may be the highest, for the less profitable, you may be the lowest.
Yeah, but in the scope of the study, you said they ignored the Kenai area, and I'm trying to determine, in your view, is that one of the significant differences?
I would say it's one of the significant differences.
Okay. Are you aware that, in some testimony, I think Senator Ryder asked the consultant, Mr. Lipton, what difference that would make in terms of the study, and Mr. Lipton indicated that it would affect the study by less than 1%. Would you agree with that, or would you argue with that?
I would agree with that.
You don't think Mr. Lipton's right about that?
I think it's greater than that.
You have taken some time, presumably, to review the study, and since, of course, the department's one of its primary functions, presumably, is to share with us what it thinks is a reasonable tax effort in this area. Rather than to constructively criticize the existing study, have you offered or proposed a similar study that would give some guidance based around the scope that you think would be more appropriate?
Yes, I think we proposed a study, and in fact, there's an appropriation bill which would provide the funds to make an independent study.
Is the scope of the study already been outlined? Have you drawn up an outline of the scope that you expect the study to?
Well, yeah, we've thought about it some, and one of the things, I guess it would probably take maybe several different sorts of approaches. One would be to use the same sort of approach here, but apply it more broadly, right, a broader scope, while at the same time, to give some idea of how valid the results would be.
Have you documented this one, by the way? Have you documented the scope that you're satisfied to you?
I don't have anything down on a piece of paper that I can give you.
How soon could you do it, do you think? I mean, you're not satisfied with their scope, and I'm not arguing with that, but I'm curious, rather than just criticize it, is there something constructive that you can offer that would establish a scope that you think would be more fair, and then we can look at that in the daylight as well?
Yes, I think we could do that
for
this weekend.
Okay,
study is not that it wasn't done professionally, but that it asked Arthur Andersen to do something that the oil industry itself had said for years to this legislature for us not to do, that is evaluate our oil policy based on one particular field.
Wouldn't the income be only 1% different? And that is true. Milton Lipton did testify to that.
make less than 1% difference, and John disagreed with it. But Milton Lipton also said when that was compared with the company's total worldwide income and divided into the apportionment formula, it would make less than 1% difference. And that was the out-of-context question that Senator Sumner used. It shows that there is a lack of understanding of what we were talking about. What Milton Lipton was saying is not different than what John said. Unless you just take it out of context. Don't consider the rest of it.
Mr. Messenger, I know that Senator Neal asked you how long it would take for such a study as mentioned here several times today, and I'm sorry that I did not hear the reply. I said I could get this information in terms of Senator Sumner's question about what we think would be an appropriate way to study them. I said I could get that structure, that information this week to him.
You're speaking of the guidelines of a study, right, the guidelines. But how long do you believe it would take you to conduct such a study?
Well, I think we would shoot for something that could be done within 4 to 6 weeks. It's a very tight situation, but
you also,
and I presume you do, but since you're the boss, agree with the need for this study.
Yes, we do.
Thank you. Are there any?
One more, Jim. I didn't get around to asking yet. John mentioned that one of the equitable methods of measuring this relative tax burden would have been to take Alaska's laws and apply them to these other states. He also used the one of applying Alaska's resource to the other state as though it was there. And we know that Arthur Anderson's representative said about that, but they didn't do it because it was physically impossible to do. But, John, I wanted to ask you a question in that relation. Is there any doubt in your mind, with the figures you have at your hand at present, that if Alaska's tax burden, total tax burden on the oil producing companies were transferred to each one of these other states, that it would produce insignificant incomes in those states, that they would be very little in comparison to what they currently do?
Mr. Lipton,
to me that, and when he makes the right statements, that we either will challenge it at that time and attempt to prove it, or I come away from there expecting to rely on some of the substance that he imparts to us. And that, so I may be a little bit confused on the ground rules, but that's, at least that's the dilemma that I'm in. It wasn't the ultimate that I was primarily concerned about in terms of their support for the report, but Mr. Lipton, who gave a dissertation on that report and answered some questions about it. That's who I had referenced to.
Perfect. I'll take it both of you that we're not dealing with just the report, we're dealing with an income tax bill. And if I understand Mr. Messenger correctly, and I hope that he will correct me if I may have misunderstood him, the study is to be done on the overall tax burden for the oil and gas industry in all parts of the land.
That's right.
And again, the question of relative tax burden is just one question of many that needs to be answered, and I don't think necessarily hinges on whether the legislature needs to correct its income tax. Maybe Alaska wants to be first, last, in the middle, or whatever. And regardless of that question, still might want to make its income tax, the one that it has on the books, effective and fair, so that it applies equally to both multi-state corporations and local corporations alike.
Here's the deal. We think the legislature deserves, a complete record before they pass a bill, whether the report is relevant or not. They need a complete record.
I agree. Thank you very much. And we'll look forward to receiving your guidelines of what's going to be in the report so that if we feel there's something that isn't being touched on there, we may suggest or ask your opinion of what the additions might mean to the report. Thank you very much, Mr. Messenger. I think we'll need a 5-minute break before we go on with the testimony from the Arctic Club people.
Produced from ASRC lands will command a price that will adequately compensate ASRC for extraction of its resources. one of the most significant areas of potential revenue for ASRC, and hence the other regions that will share under 7I, the Langston, is the net profits provisions of the various agreements we have with several major oil companies. Net profits interest is calculated on the company's profit per barrel before federal income taxes, but after deduction of all costs, including state taxes. The lower the pre-tax profit, the less ASRC and the other regions will receive. Another important factor we take into consideration is considering the direct and indirect impact.
Lisburn and Kuparuk pools are illustrative of the case for most likely discoveries on Alaska Native lands selected under the Alaska Native Lands Claim Settlement Act.
It is far more probable that any discoveries on native lands will be in the 1 to 2 billion barrel range, like Lisbon for Cardiff, than in the 8 to 10 billion barrel range, like the main Prudhoe Pool. Close that quote. The problem for ASRC is that we need to raise capital in order to find these fields, and we need oil company expertise both to find and to develop them. We can't do it ourselves. We discovered that, I think, the first day. But the future is not the Prudhoe Bay size fields, and here we feel discriminated against again. The arguments at this table are whether it's Prudhoe Bay or Cook Inlet. What about us that have fields potentially 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 500 miles away from Prudhoe Bay, and with good D2 legislation and good transportation legislation, we might be able to get something from there to the pipeline? Or what if we get in Western Arctic, where we're drilling also? We have to come up with something to get that out. Costs in Alaska are extremely high, and there are many places still left in the world, including the North Sea and Indonesia, where drilling operations are more profitable than they have been, especially in Alaska. The wellhead value after subtracting transportation is only about $3 these days, and with smaller size seals as a likely prospect for future discoveries, we cannot afford to continue raising taxes on the oil industry without directly reducing the likelihood of finding and developing marginal fields. It's just the banker just doesn't see it. He sees it more on the economic side than our hopes. Needless to say, this is some of the concern to the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, but to all the 70,000 natives who will share 70% of those profits. Alaska Natives, a lowering of expectations. With the enactment of the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, it was hoped that Alaska Native might be last able to have more of what some call the American dream. More choices in terms of employment and lifestyle, and a strong economic base from which to build for their children and their grandchildren. But the problems with the federal government have multiplied, causing long delays in land transfer and incredible costs to most of the regional corporations. The importance of the D2 issue cannot be overstated. The threat to the lifestyles of the villages and the villagers and the subsistence living is extremely meaningful and extremely difficult for them to balance. Yet few seem to realize that the state government is still now another direct threat. If either the corporate income tax bills were to pass, there would be an immediate effect not only on the oil companies, but on every native in Alaska. There would be an immediate reduction in the value of native lands to the natives who have made their selections largely based on resource values. All natives are affected because Section 7I of the Act, which provides that 70% of the revenues received by any native corporation for hard rock minerals, oil, or gas, or forest products discovered on the corporation land will be shared with the other corporations. Thus, if ASRC cannot get a billion barrel field developed or more fields found, every other native corporation and its stockholders will also be adversely affected. Not to mention the adverse effect on the state of Alaska itself over the long term. In conclusion, I'd like to highlight a number of important points that Nelson Clifton made in addressing this meeting on January 25th. May be even more important in discouraging investment than the fact of the tax burden per se. He also spoke about the dangers of giving the impression of having an ad hoc taxing policy, which increases taxes year to year, dedicated to the budgetary needs, which or the revenue deficiencies, or whatever else the case may be. As a businessman, not an economist, I have noted that the perception of Alaska as a good place to invest is already poor, and we're experiencing it. Lipton seriously presents what he called the third alternative, not to amend the income tax measure. It seems to me that the two corporate income tax bills may make more dollars and cents for the state in the near term, but it makes much more sense for Alaska at this point to stop changing the oil and tax laws. Prudhoe Bay production will begin to decline in about 8 years. Once a new field is discovered in Alaska, it takes about 8 years to get it into production. We need much more exploration time and many more discoveries in the future to replace the income from Prudhoe Bay. We think we can help you with that. A tax hike now could mean the loss of far greater revenues in the future for the state from the development of the remaining smaller fields. And we must face the fact that there probably will not be any more Prudhoe Bay. The native interest in this matter is clearly the value of our land, the revenue, and the jobs. We're learning how to handle all three with one whale of an effort on everybody's part. But the importance of the perception of Alaska is important to all of us and to all Alaskans. With billions of dollars of surplus revenues projected by the state for the future, we do have time. The passage of these bills would not just reduce oil companies' profitability, it would reduce ours, and it would reduce our chance. Either one would be damaging to economic aspirations of all Alaskans, and particularly the Alaskan Native. Can I show you where we're drilling now, so that you can get some concept?
Do we have a map that will... We have one over here that has an energy resource map of Alaska that might
Go to the pipeline is over here. We're drilling just to the west of the pipeline. But if D2 went on originally, we wouldn't have been able to go through the Wild and Sink River or some of the transportation, all the transportation through the center. Think of us, if we hit something in west of the pipeline, we've got to get it to the pipeline, and as I said, then the figures you've got going now bring us down to $3 oil. Any little increase or change in the increase of state tax itself now measures looms much larger, because we're down to whether we can do it or not. And then the other field that's being drilled over here is in the Western Arctic. So what we'd really like to talk to you about, rather than modification and house cleaning on income tax so everybody pays a fair share, is how can we get your help to develop these different things? We have 4.4 million acres, and that's been an extraordinary thing. And we do have these extraordinary costs. We are sharing with you the ICC, or now the FERC case, in which multi-millions of dollars is being spent. We are considered pivotal by the governor of Alaska, because we bring the human element to what you're trying to do. Equity.
We have attorneys in Washington, which the last is piggybacking on B2 because they are so bright. We've got to hire them there if that's where they are. We've got to have that business expense, or our stockholders are going to run out of money paying for all these things that will come in the future, maybe. We are in the possible transportation studies in the Western Arctic because if they find something there, the state of Alaska and all of us have to figure a way environmentally to get it out. All these costs are incurred prior to us finding any oil if we do find it. So they are extremely high cost dollars to us now. And just that little aspect of the bill would hurt us immediately, plus all the other features we've got. So we're off and running if you'll help us. And we're in deep trouble as you are competitor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. Are there any questions for Kim and this time? You have copies of your testimony today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify today? We do have a time
left,
so we'll have about another, maybe 20 minutes.
Mr. Pomeroy, Ms. Pauline, and members of the committee, I am Harold Pomeroy. I live at 408 Wright Street. Most of my interests are on the Kenai Peninsula, however. And I was the first mayor of the Kenai Peninsula Borough and gained some knowledge of the oil industry from association with the production people and the officials the company is concerned. I'm not a professional in taxation on the oil industry. I think I could not even say that I am a thorough student of it. I do have some impressions that I think may be useful in a very small way. Reference was made by Senator Sumner to simplicity in the approach to more revenue if more revenue is to be secured. That recalls an experience I had on the Kenai Peninsula when there were some complicated tax measures proposed that involved proposals for tax exemptions. My Chamber of Commerce friends were beating me over the head and wanting to have me submit to what they thought should be done to give tax exemptions, and then within a week, they came to me and said, well, if you need money, why don't you just apply the 3% sales tax to the total cost of drilling wells? Well, I said, what kind of a fool question is that? It all comes from the same place. And I think that there may be something in that of significance here. Certainly, we don't need additional money for current purposes. And that isn't to say that there shouldn't be more taxes, because I don't know, because I don't know enough about it. It is to say if we are going to take more, we take more simply because we say that there's an unconscionable profit going to be made, and therefore we're just going to take more. I don't comment on that. You probably have discussed that a very great deal as to what you think might be tolerable or the most that could be stood. I do have some concerns. I have some things that make me nervous that I think have a bearing upon what you're discussing here today. I came back from Juneau to Anchorage a couple weeks ago and was confronted with a current issue of U.S. News and World Report, in which an article on taxation said of these 6 or 8 or 10 states that were listed there, here was Alaska, the highest state taxes in the entire United States, almost $2,000. And I was asked if I wouldn't send a night letter to U.S. News and World Report and ask them to correct that, to say that our taxes actually were only about half that. And I said, no, I won't, because if I were a capable person on U.S. News and World Report, I would say, all right, we make a correction. The taxes aren't $2,000 a year, they're $1,000 a year. What they're doing up there in Alaska is expending $2,000 or $1,000 per capita more than they have in taxes. It's going to catch up with us a lot sooner than a good many people seem to think. We're on a collision course with insolvency if we don't proceed with the activities that will get us the most revenue that we can get. I am not suggesting that we should produce a field as fast as we possibly could if it's going to come ahead of the time that Prudhoe Bay starts going down, because we can't protect the value of that oil if we take it out of the ground ahead of the time that we need it and have it in excess. I am saying that I am nervous about the magnitude of our problem as to viability in the future. You hear all kinds of comparisons, oil here and outside, and you hear these stupid things, how much is $1 trillion if you laid dollars end to end, it would go around the world so many times. That doesn't concern me, but there's some things that do concern me. If we are to have even 300 to 350,000 barrels of oil a day when Prudhoe Bay starts going down fairly rapidly, we will have to discover 10 or a dozen swamps and river fields between now and that time. We'll have to discover 10 or a dozen times the amount of oil that is estimated by Outer Continental Shelf's economists to be in Lower Cook Inlet. And to carry the thing just a little bit further, in Texas, a 200 million barrel field is counted as a giant field. Texas would have to be drilling 3 fields a year for 15 years to equal the amount that we have in Prudhoe Bay. That's not to talk about how little Texas has, but how much we have in Prudhoe Bay alone, and how we are completely dependent upon the petroleum industry for our viability. There may be a number of places where there'll be 200 million barrel fields discovered, and we simply won't be able to produce them. I voted as a member of the Growth Policy Council to get on with Beaufort Sea. Not because I wanted to see the oil produced to add to oil from which we're getting money that is in excess to our needs now, but so we'd have it available to go into that pipeline, so we'll have a net profit as we go on. There's a lot of things Mr. Dineen says that I may not agree with, but he did make reference to the pipeline, and we have an enormously expensive proposition when it comes to our future development for getting the oil out. We don't have any reason to have confidence that we're going to have many more Prudhoe Bays. We're probably going to have smaller fields, and the expenses are going to become greater and greater and greater. Beaufort Sea will be a tremendously expensive proposition. I don't think we have the technology to be absolutely sure that we can secure those structures where we'll drill. It was easy in the Kenai Peninsula because we had benign waters, relatively, and there was a question even there as to whether you put structures down or whether you would build rock islands. And you get out in the Beaufort Sea, and there is simply no way to counter 20 or 30 or 40 foot thick ice. I don't know what it gets up there. It's 1,000 miles square. So there's a lot that has to be done, and it's exceedingly expensive. And then finally, I would say, and this is just a personal observation, if the petroleum industry had not had very profitable ventures here and here and here in the world, how on earth could they have been so successful a producer of the oil and gas that we use today? Now, of course, there's a problem that you people are going to have to deal with, and the federal government's going to deal with, excess profit. But I thought how stupid a situation, maybe I shouldn't say that, how preposterous it was 4 or 5 years ago, I forget now just when it was, when President Ford and Congress were talking about certain tax measures, and then the Vice President Rockefeller said, what we need is a $100 billion petroleum corporation, a government corporation. That would make me very, very nervous, too. And so I suggest to you that you simply be very, very careful as you go on with your considerations of what you're going to do with the petroleum industry with respect to taking more. We've got to have an industry that can be in a good position to go into the difficult areas, to go deeper and to go farther. You probably know how much is being spent in the Gulf. I don't know. I suppose when they get all through, and if they don't find any oil, they may be spending close to $500 million. So I again say, I do not know the taxation field in this regard. I am nervous about doing anything but the most simplest you can do if you're going to take more. But I would certainly look at it very, very carefully. I was in fine, I close. I was very unhappy some weeks ago to see an article quoting a man by the name of Bybee of Exxon chiding us because we weren't leasing at least one lease a year or every other month as they have in some other cases. We are sure different from outside. But we do need to be carefully planning so that we will not be insolvent a few years down the road because we've got nothing other than oil to ensure an economic viability that will pay for the public expenditures at the rate that we've come to accept. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. Are there any questions? I'd like to ask Harold, you and I both have the same concerns about funding our government, funding our state government out of revenues that we don't have. In other words, $1,000 a person,
as you said, more per year than we're taking in taxes. Do you think we should continue to do this? We're taking selling off our state-owned resources to fund this constant juggernaut of a government that we got. Do you think we should continue to do that with our revenues, or should we do it like the province of Alberta is doing it? Have you considered that they put away that part and then operate the government off of taxes, and they don't tax any more than they need to run the government?
We should try gradually to reduce this expenditure greater than the general taxes bring in. I'm concerned about the future from the standpoint of how much money we get. But I'm also nervous about whether or not we're just constantly escalating costs and our having to go all the way from the Denied area on the Kenai Peninsula where you have to only pipe 20 or 30 miles and send the oil to market from there. That's what concerns me. It is a matter of balance. And again, only you people, Madam Chairman, can come up with a final answer. I wish I could be of more help if I'd been in at all.
We've just heard Ms. Conroy, we've heard others, and even some of my questioning has been around the area of the roll-off in terms of revenue generated by crude oil. We've heard that there's a 5 to 7 to 9 years to produce and get wells on stream to fill in that slowdown in revenue to the study. But there hasn't, I wasn't aware of any studies or any significant data collection relating to that. And at a meeting the other day, the Royal Fleet Oil and Gas Board, there was some data presented by Marshall Pigglenberry, and I don't have that data. And I was wondering, would it be possible to ask him to present that sort of information to the committee on Friday?
Sure.
Okay, thank you very much.
There's nothing further to come before the committee.